Doris looked at the squat black cube on the central desk. It looked utterly undistinguished.
Is that it?
That's it. It stores the equations that describe the future.
How do you get at those equations?
Emeril moved a contact, and at once the room darkened, and then came to life in a variegated glow. All around Doris were symbols, arrows, lines, mathematical signs of one sort or another. They seemed to be moving, spiraling. But when she focused her eyes on any particular portion, it seemed to be standing still. She said,
"Is that the future, then?"
"It may be," said Emeril, turning off the instrument. "I had it at full expansion so you could see the symbols. Without expansion, nothing is visible but patterns of light and dark."
"And by studying those equations, you are able to judge what the future holds in store for us?"
"In theory." The room was now back to its mundane appearance. "But there are two difficulties."
"Oh, what are they?"
"To begin with, no human mind has created those equations directly. We have merely spent decades programming more powerful computers, and they have devised and stored the equations. But of course we don't know if they are valid and have meaning. It depends entirely on how valid and meaningful the programming is in the first place."
"They could be all wrong, then?"
"They could be." Emeril rubbed his eyes, and Doris could not help thinking how old and tired he seemed to have grown in the last couple of years. He was younger than Harry by nearly a dozen years, but he seemed much older. "Of course," Emeril went on in a rather weary voice, "we hope that they aren't all wrong. But that's where the second difficulty comes in. Although Harry and I have been testing and modifying them for decades, we can never be sure what the equations mean. The computer has constructed them, so it is to be presumed they must mean something. But what? There are portions that we think we have worked out. In fact, right now, I'm working on what we call Section A23, a particularly knotty system of relationships. We have not yet been able to match it with anything in the real universe. Still, each year sees us further advanced, and I look forward confidently to the establishment of psychohistory as a legitimate and useful technique for dealing with the future."
"How many people have access to these prime radiants?"
"Every mathematician in the project has access, but not at will. There have to be applications and time allotted, and the prime radiant has to be adjusted to the portion of the equations a mathematician wishes to refer to. It gets a little complicated when everyone wants to use the prime radiant at the same time. Right now, things are slow, possibly because we're still in the aftermath of Harry's birthday celebration."
"Is there any plan for constructing additional prime radiants?"
Emeril thrust out his lips. "Yes and no. It would be very helpful if we had a third, but someone would have to be in charge of it. It can't just be a community possession. I have suggested to Harry that Tamwile Elar, you know him, I think."
"Yes, I do."
"That Elar have a third prime radiant. His achaotic equations and the electroclarifier he thought up make him clearly the third man in the project after Harry and myself." Harry hesitates, however.
"Why, do you know?"
"If Elar gets one, he is openly recognized as the third man, over the head of other mathematicians who are older and who have more senior status in the project. There might be some political difficulty, so to speak. I think that we can't waste time in worrying about internal politics, but Harry, well, you know Harry."
"Yes, I know, Harry. Suppose I tell you that Lynn has seen the Prime Radiant.
Lynn?
Colonel Hender Lynn of the Junta, Tenar's lackey.
I doubt that very much, Doors.
He has spoken of spiraling equations, and I have just seen them produced by the Prime Radiant. I can't help but think he's been here and seen it working.
Emeril shook his head. I can't imagine anyone bringing a member of the Junta into Harry's office, or mine.
Tell me, who in the project do you think is capable of working with the Junta in this fashion?
No one, said Emeril flatly, and with clearly unlimited faith. That would be unthinkable. Perhaps Lynn never saw the Prime Radiant, but was merely told about it.
Who would tell him about it?
Emeril thought a moment and said, No one.
Well now, you talked about internal politics a while ago, in connection with the possibility of Elar having a third Prime Radiant. I suppose in a project such as this one, with hundreds of people, there are little feuds going on all the time. Frictions, quarrels.
Oh, yes. Poor Harry talks to me about it every once in a while. He has to deal with them in one way or another, and I can well imagine what a headache it must be for him.
Are these feuds so bad that they interfere with the working of the project?
Not seriously.
Are there any people who are more quarrelsome than others, or any who draw more resentment than others? In short, are there people you can get rid of, and perhaps remove 90% of the friction at the cost of 5 or 6% of the personnel?
Emeril raised his eyebrows. It sounds like a good idea, but I don't know whom to get rid of. I don't really participate in all the minutiae of internal politics. There's no way of stopping it, so for my part I merely avoid it.
That's strange, said Doors. Aren't you in this way denying any credibility to psychohistory?
In what way?
How can you pretend to reach a point where you can predict and guide the future when you cannot analyze and correct something as homegrown as personal frictions in the very project that promises so much?
Emeril chuckled softly.
It was unusual, for he was not a man who was given to humor and laughter.
I'm sorry, Doris, but you picked on the one problem that we have solved, after a manner of speaking. Harry himself identified the equations that represented the difficulties of personal friction years ago, and I myself then added the final touch last year.
I found that there were ways in which the equations could be changed so as to indicate a reduction in friction. In every such case, however, a reduction in friction here meant an increase in friction there. Never at any time was there a total decrease, or, for that matter, a total increase in the friction within a closed group, that is, one in which no old members leave and no new members come in. What I proved, with the help of Elar's achaotic equations, was that this was true despite any conceivable action anyone could take. Harry calls it the law of conservation of personal problems. It gave rise to the notion that social dynamics has its conservation laws as physics does, and that, in fact, it is these laws that offer us the best possible tools for solving the truly troublesome aspects of psychohistory.
Doris said,
Rather impressive. But what if you end up finding that nothing at all can be changed, that everything that is bad is conserved, and that to save the empire from destruction is merely to increase destruction of another kind? Actually, some have suggested that, but I don't believe it. Very well. Back to reality. Is there anything in the frictional problems within the project that threaten Harry? I mean, with physical harm? Harm, Harry? Of course not. How can you suggest such a thing? Might there not be some who resent Harry for being too arrogant, too pushy, too self-absorbed, too eager to grab all the credit? Or, if none of these things apply, might they not resent him simply because he has run the project for so long a time?
I never heard anyone say such a thing about Harry. Doris seemed dissatisfied.
I doubt that anyone would say such things in your hearing, of course. But thank you, Hugo, for being so helpful and for giving me so much of your time.
Emeril stared after her as she left. He felt vaguely troubled, but then returned to his work and let other matters drift away. Chapter 20. One way Harry Seldon had, out of not too many ways, for pulling away from his work for a time, was to visit Rach's apartment just outside the university grounds. To do this invariably filled him with love for his foster son. There were ample grounds. Rach had been good, capable, and loyal. But besides that was the strange quality Rach had of inspiring trust and love in others. Harry had observed it when Rach was a 12-year-old street boy who somehow pulled at his own and at Dora's heartstrings. He remembered how Rach had affected Rochelle, the one-time mayor of Y. Harry remembered how Joranum had trusted Rach, which led to his own destruction. Rach had even managed to win the heart of the beautiful Manella. Harry did not completely understand this particular quality that Rach embodied, but he enjoyed whatever contact he had with his foster son. He entered the apartment with his usual, "All well here?" Rach put aside the holographic material he was working with and rose to greet him. "All well, Dad." "I don't hear Wanda." "For good reason. She's out shopping with her mother." Seldon seated himself and looked good-humoredly at the chaos of reference material. "How's the book coming?" "It's doing fine. It's me who might not survive." He sighed. "But for once, we'll get the straight poop on Dahl. Nobody's ever written a book devoted to that section, would you believe?" Seldon had always noted that whenever Rach talked of his home sector, his Dahlite accent always strengthened. Rach said, "And how are you, Dad? Glad the festivities are over?" "Enormously. I hated just about every minute of it." "Not so anyone could notice." "Listen, I had to wear a mask of sorts. I didn't want to spoil the celebration for everyone else." "You must have hated it when Mom chased after you onto the palace grounds. Everyone I know has been talking about that." "I certainly did hate it. Your mother, Rach, is the most wonderful person in the world, but she is very difficult to handle. She might have spoiled my plans." "What plans are those, Dad?" Seldon settled back. It was always pleasant to speak to someone in whom he had total trust and who knew nothing about psychohistory. More than once he had bounced thoughts off Rach and had worked them out into more sensible forms than would have been the case if those same thoughts had been mulled over in his mind. He said, "Are we shielded?"
"Always."
"Good. What I did was to set General Tenar thinking along curious lines."
"What lines?"
"Well, I discussed taxation a bit and pointed out that, in the effort to make taxation rest evenly on the population, It grew more and more complex, unwieldy, and costly. The obvious implication was that the tax system must be simplified.
That seems to make sense.
Up to a point. But it is possible that as a result of our little discussion, Tenar may oversimplify. You see, taxation loses effectiveness at both extremes. Overcomplicate it, and people cannot understand it, and pay for an overgrown and expensive tax organization. Oversimplify it, and people consider it unfair and grow bitterly resentful. The simplest tax is a poll tax, in which every individual pays the same amount. But the unfairness of treating rich and poor alike in this way is too evident to overlook.
And you didn't explain this to the general?
Somehow, I didn't get a chance.
Do you think the general will try a poll tax?
I think he will plan one. If he does, the news is bound to leak out, and that alone would suffice to set off riots and possibly upset the government.
And you've done this on purpose, Dad?
Of course. Rach shook his head.
I don't quite understand you, Dad. In your personal life, you're as sweet and gentle as any person in the empire. Yet you can deliberately set up a situation in which there will be riots, suppression, deaths. There'll be a lot of damage done, Dad. Have you thought of that?
Selden leaned back in his chair and said sadly, I think of nothing else, Rach. When I first began my work on psychohistory, it seemed a purely academic piece of research to me. It was something that could not be worked out at all in all likelihood, and if it was, it would not be something that could be practically applied. But the decades pass, and we know more and more, and then comes the terrible urge to apply it.
So that people can die?
No, so that fewer people can die. If our psychohistorical analyses are correct now, then the junta cannot survive for more than a few years, and there are various alternative ways in which it can collapse. They will all be fairly bloody and desperate. This method, the taxation gimmick, should do it more smoothly and gently than any other if, I repeat, our analyses are correct. If they're not correct, what then?
In that case, we don't know what might happen.
Still, psychohistory must reach the point where it can be used, and we've been searching for years for something in which we have worked out the consequences with a certain assuredness and can find those consequences tolerable as compared with alternatives. In a way, this taxation gimmick is the first great psychohistoric experiment.
I must admit, it sounds like a simple one.
It isn't. You have no idea how complex psychohistory is. Nothing is simple. The poll tax has been tried now and then throughout history. It is never popular, and it invariably gives rise to resistance of one form or another. But it almost never results in the violent overthrow of a government. After all, the powers of governmental oppression may be too strong, or there may be methods whereby the people can bring to bear their opposition in a peaceful manner and achieve redress. If a poll tax were invariably, or even just sometimes, fatal, then no government would ever try it. It is only because it isn't fatal that it is tried repeatedly. The situation on Trantor is, however, not exactly normal. There are certain instabilities that seem clear in psychohistorical analysis, which make it seem that resentment will be particularly strong and repression particularly weak.
Rach sounded dubious.
I hope it works, Dad, but don't you think that the general will say that he was working under psychohistorical advice and bring you down with him?
I suppose he recorded our little session together, but if he publicizes that, it will show clearly that I urged him to wait till I could analyze the situation properly and prepare a report, And he refused to wait.
And what does Mom think of all this?
Selden said, I haven't discussed it with her. She's off on another tangent altogether.
Really?
Yes. She's trying to sniff out some deep conspiracy in the project aimed at me. I imagine she thinks there are many people in the project who would like to get rid of me.
Selden sighed.
I'm one of them, I think. I would like to get rid of me as director of the project and leave the gathering responsibilities of psychohistory to others.
Rach said, What's bugging Mom is Wanda's dream. You know how Mom feels about protecting you. I'll bet even a dream about your dying would be enough to make her think of a murder conspiracy against you.
I certainly hope there isn't one.
And at the idea of it, both men laughed.
Chapter 21 The small electroclarification laboratory was, for some reason, maintained at a temperature somewhat lower than normal, and Doris Van Avely wondered idly why that might be. She sat quietly, waiting for the one occupant of the lab to finish whatever it was she was doing.
Doris eyed the woman carefully. Slim, with a long face. Not exactly attractive, with her thin lips and receding jawline, but a look of intelligence shone in her dark brown eyes. The glowing nameplate on her desk said, Cinda Monet.
She turned to Doris at last and said, My apologies, Dr. Van Avely, but there are some procedures that can't be interrupted even for the wife of the director.
I would have been disappointed in you if you had neglected the procedure on my behalf. I have been told some excellent things about you.
That's always nice to hear. Who's been praising me?
Quite a few, said Doris. I gather that you are one of the most prominent non-mathematicians in the project.
Monet winced.
There's a certain tendency to divide the rest of us from the aristocracy of mathematics. My own feeling is that, if I'm prominent, then I'm a prominent member of the project. It makes no difference that I'm a non-mathematician.
That certainly sounds reasonable to me. How long have you been with the project?
2.5 years. Before that, I was a graduate student in radiational physics at Strehling, and while I was doing that, I served a couple of years with the project as an intern.
You've done well at the project, I understand.
I've been promoted twice, Dr. Van Avely.
Have you encountered any difficulties here, Dr. Monet? Whatever you say will be held confidential.
The work is difficult, of course, but if you mean, have I run into any social difficulties, the answer is no. At least, not any more than one would expect in any large and complex project, I imagine.
And by that you mean?
Occasional spats and quarrels. We're all human.
But nothing serious.
Monet shook her head. Nothing serious.
My understanding, Dr. Monet, said Doris, is that you have been responsible for the development of a device important to the use of the prime radiant. It makes it possible to cram much more information into the prime radiant.
Monet broke into a radiant smile.
Do you know about that?
Yes, the electroclarifier. After that was developed, Professor Selden established this small laboratory and put me in charge of other work in that direction.
I'm amazed that such an important advance did not bring you up into the higher echelons of the project.
Oh, well, said Monet, looking a trifle embarrassed. I don't want to take all the credit. Actually, my work was only that of a technician. A very skilled and creative technician, I like to think, but there you are.
And who worked with you?
Didn't you know? It was Tamwile Ilar. He worked out the theory that made the device possible,
and I designed and built the actual instrument.
Does that mean he took the credit, Dr. Monet?
No, no, you mustn't think that. Dr. Ilar is not that kind of man. He gave me full credit for my share of the work. In fact, it was his idea to call the device by our names, both our names. But he couldn't.
Why not?
Well, that's Professor Selden's rule, you know. All devices and equations are to be given functional names and not personal ones to avoid resentment. So the device is just the electroclarifier. When we're working together, however, he gives the device our names. And I tell you, Dr. Van Abbele, it sounds grand. Perhaps someday all of the project personnel will use the personal name. I hope so.
I hope so, too, said Doris politely.
You make Ilar sound like a very decent individual.
He is. He is, said Monet earnestly.
He is a delight to work for. Right now, I'm working on a new version of the device, which is more powerful, and which I don't quite understand. I mean, what it's to be used for. However, he's directing me there.
And are you making progress?
Indeed. In fact, I've given Dr. Ilar a prototype, which he plans to test. If it works out, we can proceed further.
It sounds good, agreed Doris. What do you think would happen if Professor Selden were to resign as director of the project, if he were to retire? Monet looked surprised.
Is the professor planning to retire?
Not that I know of. I'm presenting you with a hypothetical case. Suppose he retires. Who do you think would be a natural successor? I think, from what you have said, that you would favor Professor Ilar as the new director.
Yes, I would, responded Monet after a trifling hesitation. He's far and away the most brilliant of the new people, and I think he could run the project in the best possible way. Still, he's rather young. There are a considerable number of old fossils, well, you know what I mean, who would resent being passed over by a young squirt.
Is there any old fossil you're thinking of in particular? Remember, this is confidential.
Quite a few of them, but there's Dr. Amaril. He's the heir apparent.
Yes, I see what you mean. Doris rose.
Well, thank you so much for your help. I'll let you return to your work now.
She left, thinking about the electroclarifier and about Amaril. Chapter 22 Hugo Amaril said, Here you are again, Doris.
Sorry, Hugo, I'm bothering you twice this week. Actually, you don't see anyone very often, do you?
Amaril said, I don't encourage people to visit me, no. They tend to interrupt me and break my line of thought. Not you, Doris. You're altogether special, you and Harry. There's never a day I don't remember what you two have done for me. Doris waved her hand.
Forget it, Hugo. You've worked hard for Harry, and any trifling kindness we did for you has long been overpaid. How's the project going? Harry never talks about it. Not to me, anyway.
Amaril's face lightened, and his whole body seemed to take on an infusion of life.
Very well. Very well. It's difficult to talk about it without mathematics, but the progress we've made in the last 2 years is amazing, more than in all the time before that. It's as though, after we've been hammering away and hammering away, things have finally begun to break loose.
I've been hearing that the new equations worked out by Dr. Ilar have helped the situation.
The achaotic equations?
Yes, enormously.
And the electroclarifier has been helpful, too. I spoke to the woman who designed it.
Cinda Monet?
Yes, that's the one.
A very clever woman. We're fortunate to have her.
Tell me, Hugo, you work at the Prime Radiant virtually all the time, don't you?
I'm more or less constantly studying it, yes.
And you study it with the electroclarifier?
Certainly.
Don't you ever think of taking a vacation, Hugo?
Amaryl looked at her owlishly, blinking slowly.
A vacation?
Yes, surely you've heard the word. You know what a vacation is. Why should I take a vacation?
Because you seem dreadfully tired to me.
A little, now and then. But I don't want to leave the work.
Do you feel more tired now than you used to?
A little. I'm getting older, Doris.
You're only 49.
That's still older than I've ever been before.
Well, let it go. Tell me, Hugo, just to change the subject, how is Harry doing at his work? You've been with him so long that no one could possibly know him better than you do, not even I, at least as far as his work is concerned.
He's doing very well, Doris. I see no change in him. He still has the quickest and brightest brain in the place. Age is having no effect on him, at least not so far.
That's good to hear. I'm afraid that his own opinion of himself is not as high as yours is. He's not taking his age well. We had a difficult time getting him to celebrate his recent birthday. Were you at the festivities, by the way? I didn't see you.
I attended part of the time. But you know, parties of that kind are not the sort of thing I feel at home with.
Do you think Harry is wearing out? I'm not referring to his mental brilliance. I'm referring to his physical capacities. In your opinion, is he growing tired? Too tired to bear up under his responsibilities?
Amaryl looked astonished. I never gave it any thought. I can't imagine him growing tired.
He may be just the same. I think he has the impulse now and then to give up his post and hand the task over to some younger man.
Amaryl sat back in his chair and put down the graphic stylus he had been fiddling with ever since Doris had entered.
What? That's ridiculous. Impossible. Are you sure?
Absolutely. He certainly wouldn't consider such a thing without discussing it with me, and he hasn't.
Be reasonable, Hugo. Harry is exhausted. He tries not to show it, but he is. What if he does decide to retire? What would become of the project? What would become of psychohistory?
Amaryl's eyes narrowed. Are you joking, Doris?
No, I'm just trying to look into the future.
Surely, if Harry retires, I succeed to the post. He and I ran the project for years before anyone else joined us. He and I. No one else. Except for him, no one knows the project as I do. I'm amazed you don't take my succession for granted, Doris.
Doris said, There's no question in my mind, or in anyone else's, that you are the logical successor. But do you want to be? You may know everything about psychohistory. But do you want to throw yourself into the politics and complexities of a large project and abandon much of your work in order to do so? Actually, it's trying to keep everything moving smoothly that's been wearing Harry down. Can you take on that part of the job?
Yes, I can. And it's not something I intend to discuss. Look here, Doris. Did you come here to break the news that Harry intends to ease me out?
Doris said, Certainly not. How could you think that of Harry? Have you ever known him to turn on a friend?
Very well, then. Let's drop the subject.
Really, Doris, if you don't mind, there are things I must do.
Abruptly, he turned away from her and bent over his work once more.
Of course. I didn't mean to take up this much of your time.
Doris left, frowning. Chapter 23. Rach said,
Come in, Mom. The coast is clear. I've sent Manella and Wanda off somewhere.
Doris entered, looked left and right out of sheer habit, and sat down in the nearest chair.
Thanks, said Doris.
For a while she simply sat there, looking as if the weight of the empire were on her shoulders. Rach waited, then said,
I never got a chance to ask you about your wild trip into the palace grounds. It isn't every guy who has a mom who can do that.
We're not talking about that, Rach.
Well then, tell me. You're not one for giving anything away by facial expressions, but you look sort of down. Why is that?
Because I feel, as you say, sort of down. In fact, I'm in a bad mood because I have terribly important things on my mind, and there's no use talking to your father about it. He's the most wonderful man in the world, but he's very hard to handle. There's no chance that he'd take an interest in the dramatic. He dismisses it all as my irrational fears for his life and my subsequent attempts to protect him.
Come on, Mom. You do seem to have irrational fears where Dad's concerned. If you've got something dramatic in mind, it's probably all wrong.
Thank you. You sound just like he does, and you leave me frustrated. Absolutely frustrated.
Well then, unburden yourself, Mom. Tell me what's on your mind, from the beginning.
It starts with Wanda's dream.
Wanda's dream? Mom, maybe you'd better stop right now. I know that Dad won't want to listen if you start that way. I mean, come on. A little kid has a dream, and you make a big deal of it. That's ridiculous.
I don't think it was a dream, Rach. I think what she thought was a dream were two real people talking about what she thought concerned the death of her grandfather.
That's a wild guess on your part. What possible chance does this have of being true?
Just suppose it is true. The one phrase that remained with her was lemonade death. Why should she dream that? It's much more likely that she heard that and distorted the words she heard. In which case, what were the undistorted words?
I can't tell you, said Rach, his voice incredulous.
Doris did not fail to catch that.
You think this is just my sick invention. Still, if I happen to be right, I might be at the start of unraveling a conspiracy against Harry right here in the project.
Are there conspiracies in the project? That sounds as impossible to me as finding significance in a dream.
Every large project is riddled with angers, frictions, jealousies of all sorts.
Sure. Sure. We're talking nasty words and faces and nose-thumbing and tail-bearing. That's nothing at all like talking conspiracy. It's not like talking about killing Dad.
It's just a difference in degree. A small difference, maybe.
You'll never make Dad believe that. For that matter, you'll never make me believe that.
Rach walked hastily across the room and back again.
And you've been trying to nose out this so-called conspiracy, have you?
Doris nodded.
And you failed.
Doris nodded.
Doesn't it occur to you that you failed because there is no conspiracy, Mom?
Doris shook her head.
I've failed so far, but that doesn't shake my belief that one exists. I have that feeling.
Rach laughed. You sound very ordinary, Mom. I would expect more from you than I have that feeling.
There is one phrase that I think can be distorted into lemonade. That's lemon-aided.
Lemonaded? What's that?
Lemon-aided. Two words.
A layman is what the mathematicians at the project call non-mathematicians.
Well?
Suppose, interjected Doris firmly, someone spoke of lemon-aided death, meaning that some way could be found to kill Harry in which one or more non-mathematicians would play an essential role. Might that not have sounded to Wanda like lemonade death, considering that she had never heard the phrase lemon-aided any more than you did, but that she was extraordinarily fond of lemonade?
Are you trying to tell me that there were people in Dad's private office, of all places? How many people, by the way?
Wanda, in describing her dream, says two. My own feeling is that one of the two was none other than Colonel Hender Lynn of the Junta, and that he was being shown the Prime Radiant, and that there must have been a discussion involving the elimination of Harry.
You're getting wilder and wilder, Mom. Colonel Lynn and another man in Dad's office talking murder, and not knowing that there was a little girl hidden in a chair overhearing them. Is that it?
More or less.
In that case, if there is mention of layman, then one of the people, presumably the one that isn't Lynn, must be a mathematician.
It would seem to be so.
That seems utterly impossible. But even if it were true, which mathematician do you suppose might be in question? There are at least 50 in the project.
I haven't questioned them all. I've questioned a few, and some laymen too, for that matter, but I've uncovered no leads. Of course, I can't be too open in my questions.
In short, no one you have interviewed has given you any lead on any dangerous conspiracy.
No.
I'm not surprised. They haven't done so because...
I know your because, Rach. Do you suppose people are going to break down and give away conspiracies under mild questioning? I am in no position to try to beat the information out of anyone. Can you imagine what your father would say if I upset one of his precious mathematicians?
Then, with a sudden change in the intonation of her voice, she said,
Rach, have you talked to Hugo Amaril lately?
No, not recently. He's not one of your sociable creatures, you know. If you pulled the psychohistory out of him, he'd collapse into a little pile of dry skin.
Doris made a face at the picture and said,
I've talked to him twice recently, and he seems to me to be a little withdrawn. I don't mean just tired. It is almost as though he's not aware of the world.
Yes, that's Hugo.
Is he getting worse lately?
Rach thought a while. He might be. He's getting older, you know. We all are. Except you, Mom.
Would you say that Hugo had crossed the line and become a little unstable, Rach?
Who? Hugo? He has nothing to be unstable about, or with. Just leave him at his psychohistory and he'll mumble quietly to himself for the rest of his life.
I don't think so. There is something that interests him, and very strongly, too. That's the succession.
What succession?
I mentioned that someday your father might want to retire, and it turns out that Hugo is determined, absolutely determined, to be his successor.
I'm not surprised.
I imagine that everyone agrees that Hugo is the natural successor. I'm sure Dad thinks so, too.
But he seemed to me to be not quite normal about it. He thought I was coming to him to break the news that Harry had shoved him aside in favor of someone else. Can you imagine anyone thinking that of Harry?
It is surprising. Rach interrupted himself and favored his mother with a long look. He said,
Mom, are you getting ready to tell me that it might be Hugo who's at the heart of this conspiracy you're speaking of? That he wants to get rid of Dad and take over? Is that entirely impossible?
Yes, it is, Mom, entirely. If there's anything wrong with Hugo, it's overwork and nothing else. Staring at all those equations, or whatever they are, all day and half the night, would drive anyone crazy.
Doris rose to her feet with a jerk.
You're right.
Rach, startled, said, What's the matter?
What you've said, it's given me an entirely new idea. A crucial one, I think.
Turning, without another word, she left. Chapter 24. Doris Van Ebbele disapproved, as she said to Harry Seldon.
You've spent 4 days at the Galactic Library, completely out of touch, and again you managed to go without me.
Husband and wife stared at each other's image on their holoscreens. Harry had just returned from a research trip to the Galactic Library in Imperial Sector. He was calling Doris from his project office to let her know he'd returned to Streeling.
Even in anger, thought Harry, Doris is beautiful. He wished he could reach out and touch her cheek.
Doris, he began, a placating note in his voice, I did not go alone. I had a number of people with me, and the Galactic Library, of all places, is safe for scholars, even in these turbulent times. I am going to have to be at the library more and more often, I think, as time goes on.
And you're going to continue to do it without telling me?
Doris, I can't live according to these death-filled views of yours. Nor do I want you running after me and upsetting the librarians. They're not the junta. I need them, and I don't want to make them angry. But I do think that we should take an apartment nearby.
Doris looked grim, shook her head, and changed the subject.
Do you know that I had 2 talks with Hugo recently?
Good. I'm glad you did. He needs contact with the outside world.
Yes, he does, because something's wrong with him. He's not the Hugo we've had with us all these years. He's become vague, distant, and, oddly enough, passionate on only 1 point, as nearly as I can tell, his determination to succeed you on your retirement.
That would be natural, if he survives me.
Don't you expect him to survive you?
Well, he's 11 years younger than I am, but the vicissitudes of circumstance...
What you really mean is that you recognize that Hugo is in a bad way. He looks and acts older than you do, for all his younger age, and that seems to be a rather recent development. Is he ill?
Physically? I don't think so. He has his periodic examinations. I'll admit, though, that he seems drained. I've tried to persuade him to take a vacation for a few months, a whole year's sabbatical if he wishes. I've suggested that he leave Trentor altogether, just so that he is as far away from the project as possible for a while. There would be no problem in financing his stay on Getarin, which is a pleasant resort world not too many light years away.
Doris shook her head impatiently.
And, of course, he won't.
I suggested a vacation to him, and he acted as though he didn't know the meaning of the word. He absolutely refused.
So what can we do? Said Selden.
Doris said, We can think a little. Hugo worked for a quarter of a century on the project and seemed to maintain his strength without any trouble at all, and now suddenly he has weakened. It can't be age. He's not yet 50.
Are you suggesting something?
Yes. How long have you and Hugo been using this electroclarifier thing on your prime radiance?
About 2 years, maybe a little more.
I presume that the electroclarifier is used by anyone who uses the prime radiant.
That's right.
Which means Hugo and you mostly?
Yes.
And Hugo more than you?
Yes. Hugo concentrates fiercely on the prime radiant and its equations. I, unfortunately, have to spend much of my time on administrative duties.
And what effect does the electroclarifier have on the human body?
Selden looked surprised. Nothing of any significance that I am aware of.
In that case, explain something to me, Harry. The electroclarifier has been in operation for over 2 years, and in that time you've grown measurably more tired, crotchety, and a little out of touch. Why is that?
I'm getting older, Doris.
Nonsense. Whoever told you that 60 is crystallized senility? You're using your age as a crutch and a defense, and I want you to stop it. Hugo, though he's younger, has been exposed to the electroclarifier more than you have, and as a result, he is more tired, more crotchety, and in my opinion, a great deal less in touch than you are. And he is rather childishly intense about the succession. Don't you see anything significant in this?
Age and overwork, that's significant.
No. It's the electroclarifier. It's having a long-term effect on the two of you.
After a pause, Selden said, I can't disprove that, Doris, but I don't see how it's possible. The electroclarifier is a device that produces an unusual electronic field, but it is still only a field of the type to which human beings are constantly exposed. It can't do any unusual harm. In any case, we can't give up its use. There's no way of continuing the progress of the project without it.
Now, Harry, I must ask something of you, and you must cooperate with me on this. Go nowhere outside the project without telling me, and do nothing out of the ordinary without telling me. Do you understand?
Doris, how can I agree to this? You're trying to put me into a straitjacket.
It's just for a while, a few days, a week.
What's going to happen in a few days or a week?
Doris said, Trust me, I will clear up everything.
Chapter 25 Harry Selden knocked gently with an old-fashioned code, and Hugo Amaril looked up.
Harry, how nice of you to drop around.
I should do it more often. In the old days, we were together all the time. Now there are hundreds of people to worry about, here, there, and everywhere, and they get between us. Have you heard the news?
What news?
The junta is going to set up a poll tax. A nice, substantial one. It will be announced on Trentor Vision tomorrow. It will be just Trentor for now, and the outer worlds will have to wait. That's a little disappointing. I had hoped it would be empire-wide all at once. But apparently I didn't give the General enough credit for caution.
Amaryl said. Trantor will be enough. The outer worlds will know that their turn will follow in not too long a time. Now we'll have to see what happens. What will happen is that the shouting will start the instant the announcement is out, and the riots will begin even before the new tax goes into effect. What will happen is that the shouting will start the instant the announcement is out, and the riots will begin even before the new tax goes into effect. Are you sure of it? Amaryl put his Prime Radiant into action at once and expanded the appropriate section. See for yourself, Harry. I don't see how that can be misinterpreted, and that's the prediction under the particular circumstances that now exist. If it doesn't happen, it means that everything we've worked out in psychohistory is wrong, and I refuse to believe that. I'll try to have courage, said Selden, smiling. Then, how do you feel lately, Hugo? Well enough. Reasonably well. And how are you, by the way? I've heard rumors that you're thinking of resigning. Even Doors said something about that. Pay no attention to Doors. These days she's saying all sorts of things. She has a bug in her head about some sort of danger permeating the project. What kind of danger? It's better not to ask. She's just gone off on one of her tangents, and as always that makes her uncontrollable. Amaryl said, See the advantage I have in being single? Then, in a lower voice, If you do resign, Harry, what are your plans for the future? Selden said, You'll take over. What other plans can I possibly have? And Amaryl smiled. Chapter 26 In the small conference room in the main building, Temuel Ilar listened to Doris Benevoli with a gathering look of confusion and anger on his face. Finally he burst out, Impossible! He rubbed his chin, then went on cautiously. I don't mean to offend you, Dr. Benevoli, but your suggestions are cannot be right. There's no way in which anyone can think that there are, in this psychohistory project, any feelings so deadly as to justify your suspicions. I would certainly know if there were, and I assure you there are not. Don't think it. I do think it, said Dor stubbornly, and I can find evidence for it. Ilar said, I don't know how to say this without offense, Dr. Benevoli, but if a person is ingenious enough and intent enough on proving something, he or she can find all the evidence he or she wants, or at least something he or she believes is evidence. Do you think I'm paranoid? I think that in your concern for the maestro, something in which I'm with you all the way, you're, shall we say, overheated. Doris paused and considered Ilar's statement. At least you're right that a person with sufficient ingenuity can find evidence anywhere. I can build a case against you, for instance. Ilar's eyes widened as he stared at her in total astonishment. Against me? I would like to hear what case you can possibly have against me. Very well, you shall. The birthday party was your idea, wasn't it? Ilar said, I thought of it, yes, but I'm sure others did too. With the maestro moaning about his advancing years, it seemed a natural way of cheering him up. I'm sure others may have thought of it, but it was you who actually pressed the issue and got my daughter-in-law fired up about it. She took over the details, and you persuaded her that it was possible to put together a really large celebration. Isn't that so?
I don't know if I had any influence on her, but even